And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. In 1964, the Surgeon General of the United States, Luther Terry, launched a war on tobacco and lung cancer that changed the health of America. Our guest in this hour of Midday, medical reporter Mike Stobie, says Luther Terry's office provided him a bully pulpit, and he used it to take on the powerful tobacco industry. In fact, the courageous public health officer's 1964 report on smoking may have been a high watermark for an office whose influence has been diminished by bureaucratic competition and partisan politics. Currently, because of opposition from the National Rifle Association, the country hasn't had a Surgeon General since July 2013. Mike Stobie is national medical correspondent for the Associated Press. He says congressional refusal to approve President Obama's nominee for Surgeon General is just another sign of how a once-respected public office has been crippled by politics. Once the office of the U.S. Surgeon General was a bully pulpit to promote awareness of public health issues, such as the dangers of smoking under Terry, sexually transmitted diseases under Thomas Paine back in the 30s, or AIDS under C. Everett Koop in the 1980s. Mike Stobie traces the history of the office of the Surgeon General back 200 years from its origins supervising marine hospitals for injured and sick merchant seamen, and later as a federal agency responsible for responding to outbreaks of yellow fever, cholera, and plague. The first man to hold the title of Surgeon General was John Woodworth, a Civil War surgeon and a reformer who studied European techniques, improved the quality of the agency's doctors, and organized the public health service along military lines. It remains one of the nation's seven uniformed services to this day. But in recent years, Surgeons General have been hampered by declining budgets, government reorganizations, and competition from leaders of other high-profile agencies, such as the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Food and Drug Administration. Lobbying from entrenched special interest groups, ranging from tobacco to firearms, to the American Medical Association, have helped muzzle Surgeons General or block their appointments. And Mike Stobie says more than a few have been undistinguished time servers. This leads critics to question whether a weak and ineffective Surgeon General running an expensive bureaucracy is better than none at all. Mike Stobie is a national medical correspondent for the Associated Press, who earned a doctorate in public health policy and administration at the University of North Carolina. His new book is called Surgeon General's Warning: How Politics Crippled the Nation's Doctor. It's available from the University of California Press. So, Mike Stobie, I want to welcome you to Baltimore, WYPR, and the Midday Show.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with the current problem. I just touched on it a little bit here. Vivek Murthy is the doctor who was nominated by President Obama to become Surgeon General. And I mentioned the NRA here. It seems like sort of a bizarre episode, even in Washington politics. Could you update us on it?
As much as I can, sure. You're probably aware Dr. Murthy is out of Boston, and his name surfaced in November. President Obama said he was going to be the nominee to be the new Surgeon General. There was a little bit of reaction at the time. What I recall, a lot of it was, who?
Yeah.
And wow, isn't he kind of young? He was 36. A lot of people had not heard from him, and they weren't aware of his public health credentials. Around January and around the time of his confirmation hearing in early February, as you said, opposition surfaced from the National Rifle Association and from some members of Congress who shared some of the same views as the NRA. And it's been on ice ever since. We've seen the HHS secretary come and go, and we've seen her replacement, leave the office, Kathleen Sebelius, and we've seen the whole process of her replacement being named and approved. That whizzed through Congress, but there doesn't appear to be any imminent sign of action on Dr. Murthy's nomination.
Well, what did Dr. Vivek Murthy, it's M-U-R-T-H-Y, I almost slipped into Murphy there, but it's Vivek, V-I-V-E-K, Murthy, M-U-R-T-H-Y. What exactly did he say about guns that was so outrageous or put Congress on alert?
Well, he's made statements in the past about guns and gun violence are considered a public health issue, and perhaps there should be exploration of some restrictions on that. You know, in the world of public health, that's not exactly controversial. Talking about past Surgeons General, back to Coop, the famous C. Everett Coop in the 1980s, there was talk about violence as a public health issue and we need to do something. But as you know, it's very controversial. I watched his nomination hearing on a webcast, and he was asked a question about whether he would use his bully pulpit for gun control. And he said no, he didn't plan to do that. And I don't know Dr. Murthy, but I believed him. And the reason I believed him is because what we know of Dr. Murthy is that he came to President Obama's attention, or one of the ways he came to his attention was by helping create an organization called Doctors for Obama, which helped nominate Barack Obama. And his record suggests that he might be partisan himself. And if the Obama White House instructed him to stay away from certain controversial issues, one could opine that maybe that's what he would do.
Hey, I just want to take a moment here, Mike, and bring in The Daily Show and Jon Stewart just for a couple minutes here. This is how they reported on this particular controversy involving President Obama's nominee for Surgeon General.
Before our break, President Barack Obama was about to get some very good news. Congress was actually going to allow him to appoint his preferred candidate to a high-profile position.
President Obama is set to make his pick for the next Surgeon General. The White House announcing he intends to nominate Dr. Vivek Murthy for the job.
And the first Indian-American Surgeon General.
Harvard Medical School instructor and tech entrepreneur.
Hold on there, Indian-Americans. You can have your Ivy League doctor, or you can have your tech genius. You cannot have both. But he seems eminently qualified. Looks like smooth sailing for the good ship Murthy.
The second concern I have along the same line is about your comments about guns.
Iceberg! Someone said the word gun, which of course means it's time for our new segment. America stands its ground. So what were Dr. Murthy's comments about guns?
In your tweets of October 16, 2012, tired of politicians who are scared of the NRA, those are some of the words. And I would hope you would know that Americans have a First Amendment right to advocate the Second Amendment.
Yes! Americans have a First Amendment right to advocate the Second Amendment. And apparently you don't have a First Amendment right to have a different opinion from that. Everyone knows the First Amendment only applies to saying positive things about the Second Amendment. That's all. It says in there, you have the First Amendment right unless you don't have anything positive to say about the Second Amendment. Then you have to shut the up. You have to shut the up is what I'm saying. Not to mention, in addition to that tweet, Murthy also supports majority popular ideas like background checks and an assault weapons ban. In other words, stop him!
The NRA and Rand Paul have managed to whip up quite a frenzy over Murthy.
The Surgeon General of the United States ought to be focused on the major health issues of our country. Heart disease, cancer, stroke, those are the killers.
Against smoking, being against obesity, things that are bad for your health.
You know, bullets are not generally considered superfoods.
The Jon Stewart's take, the Daily Show take on the nominee of Vivek Murthy. So, Mike Stobie, does that mean Dr. Murthy is no longer the nominee, or is he still officially the nominee, but the Obama administration's gone back to square one on the nomination?
I report from New York, and before that, Atlanta. I don't claim to know all the ins and outs of Washington. There have been surgeons general who have kind of gotten in sort of a back doorway, an unofficial approval. Dr. Benjamin, Regina Benjamin, the last official surgeon general, there wasn't a very public vote that got her in. But there have also been, there was a guy named James Holsinger who was George W. Bush's nominee about 5 or 6 years ago, and he fell into controversy regarding some writings he'd made about homosexuals, and his nomination went on ice and gradually was dropped. I called Dr. Holsinger later to ask him what happened. He said, "I don't know, but I didn't withdraw my name." It may go that way. I don't know.
Let me ask you this, Mike. This issue, this episode with Vivek Murthy has led some to ask the question, do we need the Surgeon General anymore? Is the Surgeon General relevant? Why do we have this office? In fact, why do we have the Public Health Service when so much of the duties or obligations, responsibilities of this office seem to have been spread out through the other federal agencies? So let's get to that question just for a moment, and then we're going to go back into the time machine and trace some of this history here, because it's really interesting. What about that question, do we need the Surgeon General? We have the incredible shrinking Surgeon General, by your estimate. Those aren't your words, but this is sort of how you describe it in your book, especially the last 20 years or so.
Yeah. Do we need the Surgeon General? I think we really do need the Surgeon General. We need a potent, maverick voice who's just a bit apart from the rest of the health bureaucracy and is willing to speak frankly about scientific matters and medical matters, even if the conclusion that he draws is a little different than or a lot different from whatever policy that the administration is promoting. I came to the conclusion in my book that it's probably time to do away with the Surgeon General, because I went through the different reasons how and why the office became weakened, and I kind of came to the sad conclusion that I don't think it's going to be fixed. I don't think it's really in the interest of many or maybe any power brokers in Washington to strengthen this office and have a maverick voice. I don't see a lot of congressmen or the president spending their political capital on this potentially somewhat loose cannon.
You know, I read what you had to say about that in the book, especially toward the end of the book, and I wondered how the public would react if there was a proposition to do away with the Surgeon General's office. And then let me quote your book here. We have to take our first break, and we'll come back and pick up on this, Mike. You say, this is very interesting, polls assessing the Surgeon General's credibility award the position higher marks than most other government health officials. Indeed, the Surgeon General is commonly perceived, or rather misperceived, to be the government official responsible for the health and well-being of the general public. The Surgeon General stars in public service announcement commercials and speaks frequently at university commencements and national conferences. The uniform and title still conjure importance and wisdom, and for some Americans, a belief that there is still such a thing as a government health official who will level with the public when other bureaucrats won't. Mike Stobey is our guest, national medical correspondent for the Associated Press, talking about his new book, Surgeon General's Warning, How Politics Crippled the Nation's Doctor. More when we get back. The Surgeon General is indeed a public health celebrity, a post rooted in a rich history and automatically held in high esteem. Surgeon General reports remain hallmark documents in our society, cited in everything from student term papers to legislative policy debates. Surgeon General warnings are fixtures on magazine liquor ads and cigarette packaging. Quoting there again from Mike Stobey's book, Surgeon General's Warning, How Politics Crippled the Nation's Doctor. And Mike, I want to go back to you on this idea of credibility and being held in high esteem. And that question, if there's no stomach in Washington to, increase the power and the budget of the Surgeon General to go back to reverse what's happened the last couple of decades. What about public reaction, though? You say Surgeon General to the average American. They may not know the Surgeon General's name, but they know what it stands for.
Yeah, I think that's true, especially I do think there's a bit of an age breakdown on that, though. Mm. I worked on this book for about 7 years, and I talked to a lot of people, and sometimes just informal conversations, oh, what are you working on? Well, I tell them about my book. And if I talk to somebody who is especially like 30 or 35 or younger, sometimes I got a blank look there. Mm-hmm. they hadn't actually heard of the position of the Surgeon General. I mean, that wasn't all the time, but if you were 40 or over, it seemed like a bell rang immediately, a lighting up of the expression. Somebody would mention coop, or a lot of people remember Joycelyn Elders, who was famously fired for her comment about masturbation during the Clinton administration. You know, people remember that. And of course, people in health and medicine, even younger ones, are aware of the Surgeon General's reports on smoking. So I think the position has resonance. And just a few decades ago, Coop was famous. I mean, he was one of the best known figures in Washington.
He'd be on The Tonight Show.
Going back earlier, Thomas Perrin. You mentioned Thomas Perrin. He was Surgeon General under FDR. He had a best-selling book in 1937, and he was runner-up for Time Magazine's Man of the Year. I mean, these were, you know, really high-profile people.
And Thomas Perrin was noted for speaking out about sexually transmitted diseases, right?
That's exactly right, yeah.
So they were willing to take on what at the time were controversial topics. Coop got out ahead of the Reagan administration on AIDS. Can we talk about that a little bit? That might help some of our younger listeners appreciate the Surgeon General.
Sure. The Reagan, of course, AIDS began to appear in 1981 and turned into an epidemic, an awfully frightful epidemic. I mean, a diagnosis of AIDS was a death sentence. This is before we had the drugs and drug cocktails that allow people to live decades now. Back then, it was awful, and because many of the initial cases were identified in the gay community, there was a feeling by some, including within the Reagan administration at the White House, that maybe this is not a disease topic, a health issue that we should take on. Maybe this is not where we want to spend our political capital. I interviewed one or two people who even said they'd heard comments along the lines of, maybe this is God's will or something like that, coming down on the gay community. It was Coop who was the official in the Reagan administration who really, he wasn't the first to talk about AIDS and the importance of research on AIDS, but he was the one who really took it on and issued statements to the public, very direct statements, mailings to everyone's home, telling them that this is not a gay disease. This is something that affects everybody, and we need to approach this with compassion and as much energy as we can. We have to fight this in all quarters of our society.
And C. Everett Koop was known to be a social conservative, right?
Yeah, he was. He scared the heck out of a lot of people when he was first nominated because he was famously against abortion. He'd actually appeared in a film that spoke against abortion, and there was one scene where he was talking about what happens to a fetus when you abort it, and he was standing on a rock, and in the scene there were plastic baby dolls floating in the water all around him representing all the fetuses that were killed through abortion. So the Reagan administration nominates him. Jesse Helms, those who remember Senator Jesse Helms, was delighted that he was nominated, and many people in the public health community were very concerned. They didn't think that he would present public health positions that did not agree with conservative ideology. But to Coop's credit, he holstered his beliefs and he spoke right to the science, and he became the most famous Surgeon General of the last 50 years anyway.
And speaking of Jesse Helms, also there, I think Jesse Helms, according to your book and from my memory, he thought C. Everett Koop was going to be a pushover on tobacco.
Yeah. Well, Helms, of course, was from North Carolina, tobacco-growing state, and Helms had gotten pretty angry at the Carter administration because they'd been pushing anti-tobacco messages. Joe Califano was the, it used to be called the HEW Department, Health, Education, and Welfare. Califano was the HEW secretary, and he crusaded against tobacco. So Helms was delighted that Coop was there. He didn't expect to have to deal with a lot of grief. But Coop shook his finger at the tobacco industry, and he called for a tobacco-free society by 2000. He was as big or even greater a anti-tobacco crusader than Califano.
Well, I mean, he personified, I think, what you want in a Surgeon General, the independent, science-based, science-directed Surgeon General, who was appointed by the president, but operates independently based on science.
Yeah, that's what the ideal is, the adjudicator of science who speaks truth to power no matter what the truth is. Another good example is David Satcher. He's not quite as well known as Coop or Elders or some of the others, but he was appointed by Clinton near the end of Clinton's administration and served for a little while under George W. Bush. And when he first came in, needle exchange was a hot issue. Needle exchange was a way that you could combat HIV. And the research had showed that needle exchange programs worked. And they were supposed to make an announcement about endorsement of needle exchange policies going forward. Clinton got cold feet at the end. Clinton, very embattled in his fights with Congress, and just said, you know, he wasn't going to take that on. But Satcher issued a report, or he went and spoke about it and how, you know, the science says that needle exchange programs work. He went off message from the administration. So that's another example.
Mike Stobie is our guest on Midday on WYPR. His book is Surgeon General's Warning, How Politics Crippled the Nation's Doctor. Now, Mike, we want to do something here that's very important for a lot of folks in our audience, and that is talk about the uniform a little bit and what this this whole thing is. Because I must admit, way back when, before I got myself informed about the Surgeon General, I thought they were admirals. I thought they were part of the Navy. I don't know why. I guess because of the uniform, because the uniform looks from a distance or on television or in a grainy AP photograph from way back when, it looked like a naval uniform. So I thought, see, Everett Koop, you describe him, I think, appropriately here as a Mennonite farmer masquerading as a college professor because of that beard that he had. But he also, he like the others, wore this uniform. So take a minute for our audience and please explain about this uniform service, the Public Health Service Corps, where that came from, why they're in uniform.
Well, you know, the origins of the Surgeon General job were in the 1800s. There was, as you kind of mentioned at the beginning, like from the beginning of our nation, we had something called the Marine Hospital Service. It was a kind of network of federal hospitals that were for sailors, for seamen. It came from England, you know, back in the 1500s, the Spanish Armada was defeated by England's Navy, and the nation was grateful and set up a care system for seamen. And we inherited that, and we continued that. Those were our first federal hospitals. But the hospitals were kind of locally administered and subject to graft, and there were hurricanes and fires. And it was just this tragic comedy of how these things fell apart, and there were repeated calls for reforming the Marine hospital system, and finally they did it with some legislation in 1870, and they said, okay, we got to put somebody in charge here who's going to be responsible for fixing this, and they created a position called the Supervising Surgeon of the Marine Hospital Service. The title was changed through the years. It gradually became the Surgeon General of the U.S. Public Health Service. The Marine Hospital Service grew. It took on other things besides caring for seamen. It took over quarantines and fighting off cholera and yellow fever and plague and all these infectious diseases that, you know, terrified and at times devastated parts of the country. But the uniform you asked about, used to be these doctors who were at the Marine Hospital Service. It was kind of a ragtag group. And one of the things that the first Surgeons General did is they wanted to instill this excellence, this esprit de corps in these doctors, and they created these rigorous examinations, and they wanted to get these valiant and wise young physicians who were willing to go to disease outbreak areas and do the public's good. as part of that esprit de corps, they created these uniforms that they even had swords that were modeled on the military uniform, and the Marine Hospital Service kind of operated under a quasi-military hierarchy. Anyway, I'm almost done. The uniforms.
No, that's good. Take your time. This is the history that's interesting. Yep.
The uniforms gradually fell out of favor. I mean, we began to control cholera. We began to control yellow fever. Sanitation. We got rid of the mosquitoes and some of the conditions that caused these outbreaks. And the Marine Hospital Service it became the public health service, and they became more and more focused on cancer and other chronic diseases. And, you know, they weren't necessarily going out into the swamps or into the cities to help fight outbreaks. They were in labs at the National Institutes of Health or at the CDC. And wearing a uniform just kind of became a little silly, may not be the word, but it mm-hmm. just didn't have the same urgency or use as it did before. And you can see through the pictures in history books that there was a span when you didn't see Surgeons General usually in uniforms. The 20s, the 30s, I mean, on dress occasions, formal occasions, you'd see it, but they kind of fell out of favor. We were talking about Coop. Coop wanted to reinvigorate the Commission Corps, which was the part of the Public Health Service. The Public Health Service is a division of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services that includes the CDC, the FDA, the public health agencies. And he wanted to reinvigorate the Commission Corps group of employees there. And he wanted everyone to wear uniforms. And they grumbled a lot. They were like, we're doctors. You know, we're doctors. We're scientists. Why are we wearing a uniform? But he had a purpose for doing that. He wanted people to think of these positions as a bit apart and with respect. And Richard Carmona, who was Surgeon General just in the last decade under George W. Bush, also worked hard to bring back uniforms and promote that esprit de corps. So you're right. You sometimes watch a press conference at the CDC, and you're wondering why is the Navy running the press conference?
Right. The famous photograph of Luther Terry in 1964 delivering the Surgeon General's warning about tobacco or connecting tobacco use to cancer. He's not in uniform. He looks like a doctor.
He's in a suit
at a press conference. I do find this interesting. And one note about the Marine hospitals that you mentioned. One was located here in Baltimore, in Curtis Bay, way back when. But you know what I take from that story is this idea: a tradition of a uniformed service providing a public service to Americans, bringing health through hospitals, bringing doctors into places where there were no doctors at first. This was a noble service. The thing is, it's been surpassed by the growth of the federal government and other agencies, right?
Well, it was and it is a noble service. In the public health service and in the whole Health and Human Services Department, it's mostly civilians. There's about 6,500 Commissioned Corps officers who, would wear this uniform. But these are people who are even today supposed to be available for being called up and sent to Africa to deal with the Ebola situation, to all sorts of hairy situations. There were a lot who were sent to Katrina immediately after the hurricane in New Orleans and Mississippi, Louisiana. So that still exists, and they're still important, but they're not. There was a time when the Public Health Service was basically the Commission Corps, and everyone who ran the Public Health Service was a Commission Corps officer in uniform. Those days are gone. The Surgeon General, who's the official head of the Commission Corps, they're all civilians. I mean, they don't spend time in the Corps. A lot of them, in recent years, you don't even have Surgeons General who did any time in the military. They're just civilians, people that politicians knew who they appointed as Surgeon General, and suddenly they've got a uniform with three stars on their shoulder.
Mike Stobie, we're going to take another break here when we get back. What I want to do is pick up on the Surgeons General since Coop. How did we go from the era of C. Everett Koop to where we are now with no one holding that position and lots of people wondering whether we need a Surgeon General at all? We'll take a break here and come back and talk some more with Mike Stobie, national medical reporter for the Associated Press, about his book, Surgeon General's Warning, How Politics Crippled the Nation's Doctor. It's a fascinating history of a position that dates back 200 years when Congress decided to build hospitals for merchant seamen, as Mike was describing there. Today, the Public Health Service is one of the seven uniformed services established by the United States Code. Well, a short break. We'll be right back. A little bit of U.S. government, U.S. uniformed services trivia. I just mentioned before the break that the Public Health Service is one of the seven uniformed services. The others, of course, Army, Navy, Air Force, that's three, Marines, four, Coast Guard, five, Public Health Service, six, and no one listening right now can name the seventh, unless, of course, they work for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Commission Corps, which is the seventh uniform service. So, Mike Stobie, I want to go back into my question about what happened here and walk through this history. We go from the bully pulpit of Luther Terry 50 years ago and the Surgeon General's Warning to the era of C. Everett Koop, where, I mean, he was a for real celebrity and someone people listened to, held in pretty high regard by most Americans as the Surgeon General. That wasn't that long ago. That was the 1980s. There's a couple of Surgeons General that we can mention whose names come to mind since then. Please talk about the diminishing power and the politics that you say have crippled the nation's doctor.
Yeah, well, the slide actually began before Terry. You know, politics, you can't work in Washington with the government and not be subject to politics. Even back to the first Surgeon General, I mean, John Woodworth was selected because of people he knew. You know, during his service in the Union Army. But, right, as we discussed, the Surgeon General got to a position of power within the federal health bureaucracy, was at one time over the CDC and over the NIH and over the different public health agencies. But that began to slide in earnest in the 1950s. They didn't used to have a U.S. Department of Health and Human Services or health, education, and welfare. The Surgeon General and the public health agencies were in the Department of Treasury. And after that, something called the Federal Security Agency. It was in the 50s under Eisenhower that they created a federal health department, Health and Human Services Department. And when they did that, they put another position in, they had a cabinet-level secretary in charge of that department. They put another position in between that person and the Surgeon General. And at first, there wasn't much change. The Surgeon General still really oversaw those agencies and had a lot of power. But gradually, you had secretaries who wanted to become the spokesman on certain health issues. And then you had other people high up in the department's administration who who had strong feelings about what the public health agencies were and weren't doing, and that really came to a head actually while and just after Terry was in office under the Democratic administrations of the 60s. There was a guy named Wilbur Cohen, very powerful with an HEW, and he was a guy who was charged with doing a lot of important work in creating Medicare and Medicaid and environmental health programs. And he saw the Surgeon General and his officers as foot draggers who were not taking on some of the most important issues of the day, including creating health insurance for the elderly and for the poor and doing all this. And he became more and more involved in the selection of the Surgeon General, and and reorganizations of the department. And finally, it got to a point in 1968 where they just stripped the Surgeon General of his administrative powers and made him a spokesman. And that's what he's been ever since. We've talked about Coop, and he was very visible and influential, but he didn't actually have any power. He was a spokesman who, largely through his personality and partly because of a vacuum that existed around him, a bunch of other officials who didn't want to take on AIDS and you know, didn't want to stand in Coop's way either. And he just took the football and ran, and he became this, like, personality, this very powerful person, just through his voice and influence. But, you know, they haven't had power since the 60s.
But there's power in persuasion, in voice, and in influence that way. He did have a certain power. He had what was his popularity with the American public? Everett Coop, very high. Right?
It was huge. It was approaching Reagan levels. And you're absolutely right. There is power through persuasion. Maybe in the long run, it's even more important. But, you know, you need money to pay people to put together these Surgeon General reports. You need a budget to do a lot of things that Surgeons General want to do. And if you don't have that money, if you don't have those resources, the Surgeon General right now has a staff of less than 10. And a lot of those people work for another official. They don't control their own budget. There's a lot of stuff they want to do that they can't do. The days when Surgeons General could, initiate a lot of policy things and send people here and there, are gone.
About. I see what you're talking about. So that makes it difficult to even issue a report, come up with one. Yeah, I was going to ask you, as AP's national medical reporter, how do you respond when the U.S. Surgeon General has an announcement to make? Of course, right now we have an acting Surgeon General, but is that news?
Well, yeah, and let me be clear. I'm not the only national medical writer with the AP. There's about five of us, and I'm the one who covers the CDC. I do a lot of public health coverage, but I'm not in Washington, and I don't... The Surgeon General's office is considered part of the HHS coverage, so that's not something
that
I
you
write
personally
on
do. Okay, but I mean, personally... but do you consider it? Does that ring in the ear as news today when the Surgeon General speaks?
Yeah, well, you know, to me, it's partly because I did the book. Actually, today, this morning, there was a Surgeon General press conference at the National Press Club on skin cancer. He issued a call to action report on the dangers of skin cancer. And there's an acting Surgeon General named Boris Lushniak, Dr. Lushniak, who's a dermatologist. And I think, you know, he's good. He's a very good speaker, and he seems impassioned. And so that was interesting. And I didn't catch it all because I was busy with another story. But they did talk about tanning beds, which is one of the more controversial parts of the whole skin cancer problem. Some people say we need a federal health official to wave their finger at the tanning bed industry like Coop waved his finger at the cigarette industry and to push more states to enact legislation that prohibits tanning by teenagers, children, because, you know, it damages the skin. It can lead to melanoma. It's seen as a significant public health problem. So you can look at it a couple of ways. I don't actually know how we covered it. But in recent years, some of the Surgeons General report have been on relatively milquetoast topics that, you know, they're just repeating messages we've heard over and over and over for decades from public health officials. They're not very ambitious in trying to address topics that are perplexing the public, like e-cigarettes. You know, what do we do about that? Or maybe really hammering hard on the issue of antibiotic resistance and doctors who prescribe antibiotics for viral illness. There's some health officials who are extremely concerned about what's going to happen to our nation if more of these germs build resistance. The HPV vaccine, there's another issue that, the vaccine targeted at pre-adolescent boys and girls to prevent cervical cancer, but is given before they start sexual activity. Those vaccination rates are low. These are topics that surgeons general have not tackled.
And they have not tackled them, it sounds like, because they don't have the budget to tackle them with reports.
Well, that's one thing. There are, in some of my reporting, people said there were surgeons general who just, they said, "I'm happy to be here. I'm honored to have the title, and what the administration wants me to work on is what I'm going to work on." And they, as people, didn't take on some of this. I mentioned Carmona. He has said repeatedly that he did have ambitions to talk about some more controversial topics, including a global health report, which I understand would have talked about climate change. We could have had a Surgeon General 7-8 years ago doing what Bill Nye, the science guy, does now, talk about climate change, but that didn't happen. Right. So moved along.
Let me ask you this. Do we have the incredible shrinking Surgeon General because Congress has cut its money because of the partisan politics, because science has become so politicized, or because for a practical reason that the congressmen who sit on various committees weighing budgets look at this and say, this is a redundant agency. Why do we have it?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of the issue in terms of why surgeons general had low visibility is actually not so much Congress as it's been within the different presidential administrations. We've seen the CDC director, for example. The CDC director has a lot of the responsibilities that the Surgeon General used to have. I mean, he oversees, the quarantine issues and smoking, and of course we have the NIH director. So, and they've become more and more prominent spokesmen. And at times in recent years, the CDC director, you could argue, has been a more polished and more passionate speaker even on some issues than the Surgeon General. So we have this competition that's been going on. And then some argue that if the Surgeon General job is used to its maximum effect, that they should be taking on more controversial issues that the administration isn't necessarily settled on or is more conservative on. And the administration may not want a Surgeon General doing that. We're trying to – the Affordable Care Act is a great example. They need – that was a very difficult political issue, and the HHS administration was very focused on getting that enacted and getting that underway, and they did not need headaches coming from some other quarters, on HPV vaccination or something else that could distract and open avenues of attack to something else they were trying to get accomplished.
Mike, you write in your book in the final chapter, you say, as of this writing, the office of the Surgeon General is at a nadir, and yet it still may not have hit bottom. Did I say nadir or nadir? Anyway, with regret, it's my purpose to argue that it's probably time to do away with the Surgeon General.
I did, yeah. That's a conclusion I came to actually very late in my reporting process. When I did, this started as my doctoral dissertation, and at the time I wrote that, I kept thinking, well, this is an important job. We just have to find a way to fix it, to put in place safeguards, that can maybe give the Surgeon General a longer term or a more secure, independent budget, or maybe change the selection process so we have people who are a little more confident and ambitious coming into office. But after talking to a lot of people, I interviewed at least 150 people, and just watching this play out over the 7 years I worked on it, under a Republican administration and a Democratic administration, and going through histories, I just kind of one day came to the conclusion that, you know what, it's just not going to happen. So we're going to go through this exercise. We're going to have these surgeons general who, they do good. I mean, they they go to college graduations and speak, and they issue calls to action and reports that are used in policy debates. These are reports that are really written by the CDC and other health officials, but they come out under the, mm-hmm. you know, the imprint of the Surgeon General. But it's just kind of going to go along limping, and I, with, you know, with remorse even, just came to believe that it's just not gonna get fixed. So
lastly, Mike, we only got about a minute left together. But I just want to say, it sounds like you don't expect a president of the United States to appoint somebody as strong-willed, outspoken, and independent as, say, C. Everett Koop was. You just don't expect to see a president to turn around and do that.
Well, certainly not somebody who would say something that might contradict or cause headaches for them.
Yeah. Mike, thanks very much for doing this today. I really appreciate it. It's a really interesting history, something hadn't thought too much about or known too much about. So I'm glad you did it. Mike Stobe, who is a national medical correspondent for the Associated Press based in New York City, his book is Surgeon General's Warning, How Politics Crippled the Nation's Doctor. It's a new book from the University of California Press. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
Nice to have you on the show. Thank you very much, everybody, for tuning in. That's our midday for today. I want to say thanks to Bagby Pizza Company for providing lunch for our guests and our staff. Located in the historic Bagby Building, the Bagby Pizza Company offers brick oven thin crust pizza, gourmet sandwiches, pasta, salads that are made fresh daily. Bagby Pizza is open daily from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Delivery is available nightly, 5 p.m. to 9 p.m.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Brian Gilbert, Tyler Downey, Anna Muckerman, and Evelyn Feeney. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at wypr.org. Dan Rogic's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.